I'm here to introduce this chap here. And his name is Braj Bihari. And Braj Bihari is known to a lot of us for many things. And he is, what are you exactly? Born in New York into a Jewish family, boo. But he elevated himself to Krishna consciousness in 1978? Something like that. Long time ago, 26 years or something. And he's been afflicting us ever since. He has served in many temples around the world, but ended up in Vrindavan, which means he's actually a very elevated soul, because not a lot of us get invited to Vrindavan. And not only that, allowed to stay in Vrindavan. Prabhupada says 3 days. And he doesn't even follow Prabhupada's instruction. But he had his son in Vrindavan, a wonderful little chap, and a real bridge bassy, cheeky, and all that. That's why he's laughing. And so, yeah, Braj is possibly the only devotee who's gone to India and doesn't speak any Hindi, any Sanskrit, any Bengali. Hasn't got a clue what's going on. But more than that, Braj is a very good friend. He's never around when I'm in trouble. But he loves me anyway. And you can't say fairer than that about someone. So I love him too. Don't tell my wife. But he's going to talk today about pizzas and pakoras. He knows nothing about cooking. World's worst. But it's about reconciling liberal and conservative views within ISKCON. So we're really eager to hear, because he's a real intellectual and no one knows it.
Hi, Krishna. Thank you, Shonika, I think. Srila Prabhupada instructed the Sankirtan devotees, I think it was maybe a letter to the ladies, maybe Urmila Mataji remembers, to be a lion on the chase and a lamb at home, right? So sometimes we, maybe because prominent members of our society like Shonak are dyslexic, sometimes we get a kind of the opposite. We tend to be perhaps a little reticent about preaching, but we're lions amongst each other. And we tend to be sometimes a bit at each other's throats. There's a joke I'd like to, I haven't memorized it, so I have to read it. But this person was walking across a bridge one day, and I'll just use it in the first person. I saw a man standing on the edge about to jump off. And I immediately ran over and said, "Stop! Don't do it!" "Why shouldn't I?" he replied. I said, "Well, there's so much to live for." "Like what?" "Well, are you religious or an atheist?" "I'm religious." "Well, me too," said me. "Are you Christian or Jewish?" And the person about the jump replied, "Christian." "Well, me too. Are you a Catholic or a Protestant?" And the man about the jump said, "Well, I'm a Protestant." "Well, me too. Are you an Episcopalian or a Baptist?" Right? And the man about the jump said, "Well, I'm a Baptist." "Wow, I'm also a Baptist. Are you the Baptist Church of God or the Baptist Church of the Lord?" And the man said, "I'm the Baptist Church of God." "Well, me too. Are you the original Baptist Church of God or are you the Reformed Baptist Church of God?" And the man said, about to jump, "I'm the Reformed Baptist Church of God." "Well, isn't that amazing? Me too. Are you the Reformed Baptist Church of God, Reformation 1879? Or the Reformed Baptist Church of God, Reformation 1915? And the guy's, getting all excited now. He says, "I'm Reformed Baptist Church of God, Reformation of 1915. To which I said, "Die, you heretic." It's a little bit like that. for us that, and we'll get to this a bit later in the talk, but if you notice, we fight most often with those close to us, right? Family members sometimes, or in our case, people in ISKCON, or say, people who are joining the Ritvik group or the Narayan Maharaj group, they're much closer than, say, you know, some Sri Vaishnava in South India. We generally see them on the streets, oh, Hare Krishna, you know, please. You know, but the people who are closer, we tend to have more conflicts with. There's a lady named Deborah Tannen, who's a pretty famous writer in America. Her background is she's a linguist. And she's written a book called The Argument Culture. And I think if we read that book, unfortunately, to some extent, I believe our society would fit into that category to some extent anyway, to a relatively large extent, at least in some places and at some times, that we may have developed over the years a culture of argument, a culture of disagreeing, a culture of remembering what so-and-so did to me 23 years ago, August 17th. Right, or whatever, you know, and you know, you have kind of everyone in the room and you say, well, I know what he did, you know, and you know what he did, and when he was about, you know what he used to do before he was a devotee? And we kind of have everyone somewhat, there's a tendency to have people pigeonholed in that way and kind of, you know, sussed out. And one manifestation, which I'm going to talk about today, is this, liberal and conservatism, and hence the title, Pizza or Pakoras, our Radharaman Prabhu tried to give this Jewish spirit soul a heart attack just now. He planned a whole trick. He told me, well, Prabhu, you know, they're cooking 40 pizzas that you ordered, you know, for this course. And I was saying, 40 pizzas, €6 a pizza, my God. So I ran down to the, Shonika saw me running, what are you running for? I ran down to the restaurant. And they had planted the person in the restaurant to also kind of, yeah, no, we took a 40. We can't stop now. They're in the oven. Yeah. Anyway. My heart fell into, I got really heavy with the devotee, and he was like a young devotee, so he, you know, he revealed the truth after a very short time. But just about to talk about conflict resolution. I'm getting those steams coming out of my ears. At first I thought that defining, yes, Prabhu, can you hear me? Or is that a, sorry, you guys ate them, Hanuman ate them all. Can you hear me with this? Is this okay? Yeah, okay. At first I thought defining these terms was going to be relatively easy, especially kind of looking at other religious traditions. The conservatives, we can label as fundamentalists, right? We have a tendency as conservatives to think that we're right and pretty much everyone else is a somewhat greater, to greater or lesser extent, out to lunch. That only Vedic culture is culture. That a tendency to have a more literal interpretation of Srila Prabhupada's teachings. A tendency to be more standoffish to the rest of the world, and to be more standoffish to those that the conservative would label a liberal. So I thought that would be, you know, kind of how they would fit in. And those on the left wing, the liberals, I expected inclusion to be a big word in their lexicon, to be relevant to the world today. To use the word dovetailing a lot. Right, to dovetail our propensities in Krishna's service, whereas the conservatives might call it crow-tailing instead of dove-tailing. To be more creative in preaching, according to time, place, circumstance, and to ensure that the world can relate to ISKCON's teachings, even if we present them perhaps slightly differently than the way Srila Prabhupada did. To see things like interfaith dialogue as useful, and in doing that kind of dialogue, present the parts of Prabhupada's teachings that would be more easy for them to digest. Perhaps some lesser emphasis on maintaining standards, and perhaps more of an emphasis on questioning things that might have seemed taboo a few decades ago. So that was kind of when, as I was starting this process, I was thinking, you know, I can, those two categories might fit well. And what I'd like to do in the beginning of this talk is say first, you know, to set everything for the next, you know, for the rest of this time into a certain context. And that context is the basic accepting, or the accepting of the basic principles that Prabhupada has taught us. That if we're talking about liberals and conservatives or anywhere in between, we're not talking about liberals, you know, two regulated principles, or three regulated principles, no meat, fish, or eggs, right? Or, you know, or something like that. But basic tenets of Krishna consciousness, you know, incontrovertible, that four regulated principles, chanting 16 rounds, Prabhupada, accepting the statements in Srila Prabhupada's books, Panch Anga Bhakti, you know, worshiping the deity, you know, just the basic rock bottom bedrock of Krishna consciousness, but that's not. So if we're talking about liberals, we're talking about conservatives, we're talking about within that confine, and I think that's really important to say right ahead, right away. So although this clear demarcation does sometimes exist in our society, conservatives and liberals, my experience is a bit of a positive one, that it's not so clear cut. I think I have a relatively good exposure to ISKCON. I live in, my body stays in Vrindavan 10 months of the year, and so many of ISKCON devotees pass through Vrindavan. And this year I've done a lot more traveling. I went to Australasia and around America, and now here in Europe. No problem, please. And there's what you often find is something like this. If there's devotee 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So let's take some. What's an issue in ISKCON? Prasadam. Pizza or pakoras. Okay. So, you know, should you just serve Vedic prasadam? You know, exactly as Dr. Gupta has taught us to eat, or, you know, can you have pizzas and spaghetti and stir fries if you're in China and whatever, right? So there may. So here's the group that says no, Vedic prasad, and here's the group that says pizza. Okay. Then let's take another one. How about women's position in Krishna consciousness? Is that an issue? Nah. But it's dead. But anyway, if it were an issue, let's say these people think that women should be remain in, you know, the kitchen and ironing and child rearing, and that's actually the proper Vedic standard. This group says that no, you know, things, you know, let's keep up with modern times. Women are CEOs. They can, you know, and Malati Mataji is a very good GBC, and so and so. Gandharvika Mataji was an excellent temple president. So according to their propensities, they should be engaged. They're spirit souls, after all. And what's another issue? There's no issues. Hello. Either you're dead asleep or... Ritvik. Oh, okay, thank you very much. Ouch. You just mentioned the word Ritvik, and I hurt myself. Okay. So this group says the Ritviks are wrong, and this group says, no, actually, you know, they got it as together as anyone else does on Guru Tattva. So this is what I've seen a great deal in ISKCON. Definitely pizza, right? And this is considered healthy. Now let's take another example. Same group of chaps and chapatis, right? And if you say, the women's issue, the Ritvik issue, what's the other one? Prasadam, thank you. The pizza, the pakoras. Okay, you see the difference? The pakoras win, yeah, right. This is the, you know, the conservative liberal, you know, the kind of person who votes Democratic, just you know, they don't even, they go into the, this is course, to those who are Americans or whatever, they just, Democratic Party, and then they leave the, right, they just vote according to party line. This, by the way, is a much more difficult conflict, kind of conflicts to deal with than these. These will generally have the kind of conflicts that, or the discussions that are called creative, where people are looking, they can more easily be involved in a dialogue where they're seeking the right answer, and they're not fixed, and these people would tend to be fixed. And we've seen conflicts, one that I dealt with recently in a certain place, where there was two spiritual masters, who all the disciples in those that temple were initiated by. And those spiritual masters were very, very different. And so basically the devotees in the temple were just divided down party line. And it's a difficult thing to deal with. But I would say that the good news, I'd suggest it is good news, is that this is more prominent in our society. So what I'm basically saying is, yes, there's conservatives, there's liberals, on the far left, on the far right, but there's a whole bunch, and I believe the majority of ISKCON devotees that fit in somewhere in the more in the middle of that spectrum. Okay. Any questions on that? Now, how does that come about? How does somebody become way on the right or way on the left or somewhere in the middle? Well, it came to mind when I was thinking about that verse in the 11th canto, which I'll repeat the Sanskrit, agamo pa prajadesha kala karma cha janma cha dhyanam mantro ta sanskaro dasaite guna hetavaha. So this is the 10 factors that are the 10 things that are factored in to understand what motives of material nature we're influenced by. From the 11th canto. According to the quality of the religious scriptures, the water, or more generally what one drinks, one's association with one's children or with people in general, the particular place, the time, one's activities, one's birth, what one meditates on, what mantras one chants, what samskaras one performs, in that way the modes of nature become differently prominent. You know that verse, I'm sure. So I was thinking that a similar kind of analysis could be made about how we end up on different ends of that spectrum, and why so many of us are mixed, because on different specific topics, because there's our cultural upbringing before we became devotees, right? There's our training in Krishna consciousness. Do you remember when you were, your bhakta or your bhaktin leader taught you to do like this or taught you to do like that, right? Where you joined ISKCON Berkeley is very different than ISKCON Kuala Lumpur, right? Very, the way the practices and the way Krishna consciousness presents are very different. The spiritual master that you chose, right? And what interest they have, what interest in Krishna consciousness that they have. Our station in life, brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyasi, that may also very much influence us. Whether or not we have children. If we have children, the age of the children. Sometimes the world looks very different for someone who has infants and someone who has teenagers. Right, Mataji? Yes, right? Not that you have. You do, actually. Our financial status, right? The world looks different when you're scraping by to, put prasadam on the table, and when you have, pretty much carte blanche in your bank account, and so on. So the point I'm getting at is sometimes it's not just the subjects of the women's, or the prasadam, or the ritvik, or this or that. A lot of it is our experiences. Previous lives and this life. That mold our outlook on different, and give us that tendency to lean in different ways, in different points of view on different subject matters. Does that make sense? And these conditionings affect our identity, which, you know, Shonaka Prabhu talked about yesterday. And they're natural. I think the Sanskrit word, maybe you can correct me, is chittavritti, kind of like worldview, right? We have different we have different worldviews, and it would also, I think, be interesting to maybe analyze this. I haven't done it, but according to Rupa Goswami's Aparabdha, Kuta, Bija, Parabdha, and how he mentions how step by step the different results, reactions to our karma, to our previous karma, are cut away, beginning with Aparabdha, right? Then Kuta, then Bija, then Parabdha, right? And Prabhupada is the last one. So, according to our advancement, what stages we're at, and how much our conditioning maybe doesn't affect us, and how much it does. That might be an interesting analysis. So we have a spectrum of worldviews, and they're exasperated in other ways. The size of ISKCON, you ever know, we're kind of small, but we're very spread out. That's my analysis. We're small and we're very spread out. And that's, so we're very international and small. So we know each other. You know, we know so many. You know, we have everyone sussed out. And adding to that, we're extremely international, right? So you have so many different conditionings. You don't just, I mean, in some temples, like I was just in Italy, it seems it's mainly Italian devotees. But in America, you can find temples where practically no one speaks English. No, I'm serious. No, it's not, you know. There's a few indigenous Americans, tribal. But then you have people from Eastern Europe and, you know, some from Maharaj's, many from Maharaj's zone, you know, in different parts of Russia, and many people from India and wow, such cultural variety. It's practically mind-boggling. You talk to the temple president, they go, so different. Even in this country, right? The Belgium, the Flemish, very different than the French, right? Even in the same. Or in America, the New Yorkers, great souls like Irmela, are, you know, one way, and then there's people from the South who are a different way, or, you know, so. I think that that also exasperates. Another thing that really kicks up a lot of dust in the face of conflict in our society, and probably in many, many other societies, is the internet and email. You have an unbelievable ability for prajalpa. Just unbelievable. Right? You can be, what they say now, you can be in a shack in Montana. Right? Right, you know, not talk to a person for 10, and just, you know, your keyboard's flying all day, and you can have, it's the ultimate equalizer, right? You know, the person in the shack in Montana can practically take on IBM or something like that, just if he's, you know, persistent enough. And for those of us who, you know, go on a lot of ISKCON or ISKCON websites or not ISKCON websites, it can get pretty like, oh. You know, you can feel like you have to take a bath in the Ganga after going on those. And often it's some guy in Montana just, you know, or someone like that, who's just spewing whatever he wants to say. In the past, to get something published, you have a name for yourself, and there was only a few, certain number of publishing houses. And now anyone can get a printer, right? Have a computer, a printer, go to, especially in India, go to a printer with $1,000 and, you know, 5 days later, you got a book. And it looks just as bona fide as something from, you know, Munshiram Manohar. Oh, no, what's Banarsi Das, right? So these also exasperate things. And another thing is, you know, the weak, to some extent, and in different places to different extent, but the weakening of what I'll call legitimate power. Amongst our leadership, means legitimate power means that one gets respect just only from the position itself. Just because one's a temple president, just because one's a guru, just because one's a GBC. That has diminished, at least to some extent, to a greater, larger extent in different parts of the world. So, oh, and there's one other thing I forgot. It's Kali Yuga. That also may have something to do with it, right? What's that verse? Pralena parisa sabya kalo vashminya gejana manda sumana matayo manda bhagyu parita. So these are all different factors that cause not only the far left liberals, the far right conservatives, but also a lot of people in between to be at each other's throats in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Or, you know, I don't mean to always say at our throats, but to voice varying opinions and have many differences about many things. And that's not always bad. There's a saying that good relationships are on the far side of conflict. So conflict in and of itself is not a bad thing. But what does hurt us a lot is when conflict takes a certain direction. I'd like to introduce a concept here. Actually, it's two eyes, right? Like that. Naive realism. Naive realism is an interesting... It has three parts to it, and I'll explain to you the three parts. The first one is that I understand people, events, philosophy, in ISKCON Srila Prabhupada's desire, in an objective reality. That's what I think. And for most of us, we think that way. I understand it quite objectively. My beliefs are based on being relatively dispassionate and unbiased in my understanding of the information that I've been provided. Okay, so that's the first part of naive realism. Now the second part is that other good-hearted, rational people, devotees in ISKCON, will share my opinion, provided they have the same information and are as thoughtful and intelligent as me. Now, we laugh a little bit, but I think if we subtly or not so subtly think like that. And the third part of naive realism is very interesting. Failure to share my views is based either A, they don't have as much information as I do, so they're not too bad. B, getting a little worse, they're irrational, they're lazy, they're in Maya, or they are unable to be objective and reasonable. And the third person is the worst. They're biased, they're ill-motivated, they're self-interested, and one word that we would use a lot in ISKCON, they're insincere. Okay, so you see those three points that I see the first part of the, I see things clearly, based, you know, relatively clearly. Others, if they get the same information, they would also. And the third point, if they don't, they either don't have enough information, one, two, lazy in Maya, or three, they're actually have ill motivations. They're bad guys. So what's the result? My argument is that this happens a lot in our society, and especially as you start getting more to the edges. And I hope this doesn't compromise my neutrality here, but I've seen it more towards this edge. That's the one that I didn't want to put on the tape. The one over there. Conservative. Did I? I took on Shonika's dyslexia. I thought the liberals were over there and the conservatives were over there. Is that okay? Nothing to do with men and women, just...
No, but that's
okay, so over there. But that can also happen over here. So I'm not trying to... Actually, it can happen in both places. Anyway, let's not get into that. I won't go there. Any questions up till now? Still trying to figure out if you're have how much naive realism you may or may not possess.
I'm very naive because what I understand is what I understand. Anything else, I cannot understand.
And whatever you understand is right.
I'm happy with it.
Mazel tov. Only problem is when you come in touch with somebody who's not so happy with it. That's too bad, because you're on the board and they're not. No, I'm just no, but you see what I'm saying? Is yes, we can be happy with it. The difficulty is when we come in contact with people who have a different way of realizing. Now, I've been playing with the idea of changing the word naive to subjective, because naive kind of has a negative connotation. But my proposal in this lecture, and you're going to get a lot of time in a few minutes to disagree with me, is that this plays quite a role, especially again as devotees go further to the different edges in cases. Maharaj, did you have your hand up? Such a Maharaj. Okay. Yes. Okay. Kanchanavali Mataji. Krishna. Lord Chaitanya. I'm not sure about Lord Nityananda. And of course, that's questionable also. Right? Because he says, Samaham sarva bhuteshu namedvesho sina priya. But then he says, Ye bhajanti tumam bhaktya mayi te ta. So he says, he does play favorites, let's face it. But I would not go as far as calling Krishna naive. Not at all. I'll get to that though. How do we overcome that? Yes. But first I'm going to talk about what the results are. Yes.
Should we conclude that this is something bad, or let's say to accept it that this is something that we are conditioned in that way, and then just being aware of that, then somehow to live in this material world without many conflicts? Or
thank you for that question. At this point in the lecture, it's something to be aware of. At the end of the lecture, we'll talk about how to deal with it. Okay, so I'll carry on. So what are the results of naive realism? Well, we often want to substantiate our viewpoints by, there's a kind of logical fallacy called proof by selected instances, right? We have, because remember he said a lot of this reality we've created by experiences that we've had in life. So we have one or two or maybe a small number of experiences, and we're convinced that our position based on that position, based on those experiences, is reality. It can be a logical thought. And how can that manifest? Well, you ever heard of folio? You ever heard of the term folio scholar, which is it's a bit of a pejorative term, I would say, right? That we become, basically, we have our view of reality, then we go to Srila Prabhupada's teachings, and especially the folio, which is so convenient, to prove our point. Right, which is quite different than saying, here's a subject. I want to hear what Srila Prabhupada has to say about it, and I'll go with an open mind. It's quite different than to pick and choose, like, a box of candies when you were a kid. I don't know if you ever got candy. We used to get candies. It was a Hanukkah, Christmas time. And there would be milk chocolate, the light chocolate, and the dark chocolate. Well, I know we're not supposed to eat chocolate, but I wasn't initiated yet at that time. And, we would all go at my brother and I didn't like the dark chocolate. We all, oh, you didn't know? So that after, by New Year's, all would be left is all the dark chocolate ones. So sometimes we tend to pick, there can be a tendency to pick Srila Prabhupada's teachings a little bit like that. Leave the dark chocolate ones that don't match our view of reality and, really enjoy those light chocolate ones and hit everybody else over the head with them. That's one tendency that we have. In the VTE, we talk about one of the principles is academic integrity. And that is to avoid that kind of scholarship. And of course, this is aided by a fact that I think we have to accept that in many, many instances, on many, many issues, Srila Prabhupada says different things in different times, places, and circumstances. I mean, I was introduced to that the first time I read the Bhagavad Gita. Is it verse 28 and 29 or 27 and 28, where the first time he says that, that Arjuna is in Maya and bodily concept of life, and then the very next purport, he says that, this is the symptoms of a soft-hearted devoted Lord. And, I almost closed the book then. And in many things, right? There's this discussion you know, these things kind of flare up on the internet, right? Let's say about how to address women. Should it be Prabhu or Pravi or Mataji or Hey You or, you know, whatever. And lo and behold, Prabhupada often called women, well, often, sometimes called women Prabhus. And even I was told recently someone came upon someone in this room, I think, who said they read someplace that actually they saw where Prabhupada said address women in that way. And then, of course, we know there's the other times when he said, no, address them as Mataji. And so there's so many, and I think we all are, most of us who are aware of Srila Prabhupada's teachings know that we come across this often. Here's something that Jayadvaita Swami wrote about this, and it's in the beginning of the folio. The Bhaktivedanta Vedabase, published by the Bhaktivedanta Archives, is a powerful tool. And like all tools, it may be used either well or badly. Used well, it can help us discover, gather, and bring to light many teachings the scriptures and Srila Prabhupada give us. Used badly, it can help assemble false evidence, fallacious arguments, and wrong conclusions. When Prabhupada said what Prabhupada said sometimes differed. Sometimes he spoke for the benefit of an individual, sometimes for the world. Sometimes what he said was for the moment, sometimes forever. So as well as we can, we need to recognize in what Prabhupada said, not only the content, but the intent. So we come up with our view of reality, and we share that with somebody else. And lo and behold, surprise, surprise, somebody totally disagrees with us. My God, what happened? My thought on this, that happens anywhere there's naive realism. It happens, I think, it happens stronger in a religious setting, and perhaps even somewhat particularly in ISKCON, where we have made such a strong statement by becoming devotees, by dressing differently, usually shaving our heads and vegetarian, you know, so many things. And really, you know, in one sense, like if we were a gambler, you know, they have the roulette wheel. And, you know, we took all of our savings, all of our money in the bank and put it on 27 red, you know, on Srila Prabhupada's lotus feet, at Krishna's lotus feet, and putting it all there. That's a big poof. And therefore, our understanding of Krishna consciousness, if someone shakes it up a little bit, that we can feel quite threatened by that, because we wagered everything, emptied our pockets, you know, on Srila Prabhupada to win, not place or show, to win, you know, if you're a horse racing fan. So when people threaten our perception of reality, I'm suggesting has perhaps even a bigger trigger for us as devotees and even perhaps in people in other walks of life. And here's a bit of a little cycle of what I see often happens. We feel threatened. We get a little paranoid because of that, or defensive. Our position therefore hardens. We dig in our heels. Different sides are formed sometimes. Sometimes other people get involved, especially on the internet. Communications between the two differing views stops. Then perceptions of the other side often become distorted. You know, the straw man argument. You either do the straw man argument, or what is the other one? The slippery slope. You know, you start seeing or you start stating the other person's position as more extreme than it actually is. Or you say, well, if you accept this, and eventually it's going to be this, and eventually it's going to be, they're going to ruin Prabhupada's movement. Right? And so the more that polarity exists, the more people, the conflict, worst case scenarios, you know, start being predicted, and the crisis emerges, and offenses start flying around like crazy. So as I said, you know, conflict isn't necessarily bad, but when it takes this kind of turn, it can become so, because it's a healthy society that facilitates, you know, respectful dialogue of, you know, sometimes even vastly differing viewpoints. And it's also a healthy society that has a mechanism by which conflicts can be addressed in a constructive way. And that brings a deeper understanding. And let me now toot ISKCON's horn just a little bit. ISKCON has such a thing, or at least the beginnings of such a thing, and very, very few religious organizations have that. In North America, where I just came from, basically two denominations of Christianity have a national system for dealing with conflicts in the United Methodists and the Mennonites. Other, of course, Quakers, they're peaceful by nature. They just remain silent. Of course, they've had like three schisms in the last 12 years or something, so it's not, you know, quite that peaceful. But anyway, and Catholics have a few ombudsmen here and there, so it's not that, you know. But in terms of a coordinated national effort, only two churches. Not only does ISKCON have something in North America, ISKCON's the only organization in the world that is developing a global conflict management system. So really we're on the cutting edge, and that's being more and more accepted by the world. So it's interesting. But anyway, we know differences can cause havoc. They certainly do so in our society. We experience, right, sometimes conflicts can happen and two old friends don't talk to each other anymore, right? Wives and husbands can sometimes separate, even not only because of normal stuff, but even because of some ISKCON issue. Sometimes it happens. People can reject a spiritual master who's in perfectly good standing over some issue in ISKCON. So how these conflicts are dealt with is really important. So I'm going to go on to my suggestions on how to deal with these conflicts. Any one or two quick questions? Prem City, please. Yes. I did say that in the beginning, that although there's the extremes, there's a lot of, it's actually a spectrum. Yes, you're right, absolutely. Yes, Prue. Will I use specific examples to show? I'll go over the resolution process now, how to improve the situation, and if I don't give enough examples, then ask that question again, and I'll try to. Okay? All right. So, first suggestion I have is recognize our tendency towards naive realism, your point. And here's the specific suggestion I have. Is quiet that tendency by tentatively, you know, tentatively, you know, tentatively at least, assuming that even a very surprising or what we may initially think is a seemingly inappropriate point of view, initially assume that view is the result of possibly a bona fide way to see things. Set this as our default setting. You know, on computers you have a default setting, the way that, you know, you may have three different web browsers on your computer, but internet comes up, the Internet Explorer comes up because that's your default. So let's set our default setting at trusting people's sincerity. Again, remember at the beginning of this I said we're only talking within the basic confines of Prabhupada's teachings. So if people are within the basic confines of Prabhupada's teachings, let's make our descent to not immediately question their sincerity, to not immediately say they're in Maya. And because what happens when people prematurely question our sincerity? I mean, practically speaking, in one sense, that's all we have. And when someone questions the one thing we have, some sincerity to serve Krishna or to serve Prabhupada, that really is a dagger. Give people the benefit of the doubt. Because we do, you know, as I was saying, I do feel sometimes we have that argumentative culture. And we have people pegged, and there's some tendency to look at the faults instead of appreciate. I got an email the other day from a woman that I'm working with, an elderly lady who's an ombudsman for the Catholic Church, and she was passing through the O'Hare Airport, and she met Romapad Swami. And she went on and on. What a saintly person. Such a wonderful soul. Reminds me, you know, she said, just reminds me of the best bishops in the Catholic Church, she said. And he was just so kind-hearted and saintly, and she was also very impressed that he was all those things and very also computer literate, that he was, you know, doing his emails in the airport, you know. You know. And it was great to just see someone who didn't have Romapad. So I knew him, and it was when he was Bhakta Brian in Brooklyn, you know, all that, you know, just to really just appreciate a Vaishnava. It was so nice to get an email like that from her. It was wonderful. And here's a very appropriate letter from Srila Prabhupada. This is from Bombay, a letter when Prabhupada was in Bombay in February of 1972. It is not so much that because there may be some faults in our God brothers and God sisters, or because there may be some mismanagement or lack of cooperation, that this is due to being impersonalists. Like, the question must have been somewhat about impersonalism. No. It is a nature of the living condition to always have some fault. Even in the spiritual world, there is some fault and envy. Sometimes the gopis will quarrel over Krishna's favor. And once Krishna was so attracted to Radharani that by mistake he tried to milk the bull instead of the cow. And sometimes when the gopis used to put on their dress and makeup for seeing Krishna, they would be too much hasty and smear kumkum and mascara in the wrong places. And their ornaments and dresses would appear as if small children had been trying to dress themselves. And they were not very expert like that. So we shall not expect that anywhere there is any utopia. Rather, that is impersonalism. People should not expect that even in the Krishna consciousness society there will be utopia, because devotees are persons. Therefore, there will always be some lacking. But the difference is that they're lacking because they have given up everything to serve Krishna, money, jobs, reputation, wealth, big educations, everything. Their lackings have become transcendental, because despite everything they may do, their topmost intention, is to serve Krishna. One who is engaged in my devotional service, despite the most abominable action, is to be considered saintly because he is rightly situated. Prabhupada quotes that. The devotees of Krishna are the most exalted persons on the planet, better than kings, all of them. So we should always remember that, and like the bumblebee, always look for the nectar or the best qualities of a person. Not like the utopians, who are like the flies who always go to the open sores or find the faults in a person. And because they cannot find any utopia, or because they cannot find anyone without faults, they want to become void, merge, nothing. This is your class this morning. They think that is utopia, to become void of personality. So if there is sometimes slight disagreements between devotees, it is not due to impersonalism, but it is because they are persons. And such disagreements should not be taken very seriously. The devotee is always pessimistic about the material world, but very optimistic about spiritual life. So in this way, you should consider that anyone engaged in Krishna's service is always the best person. That was to Atreya Rishi Prabhu. So that's my first point, to recognize this tendency in us, and at least initially, because we all know we can find fault with it. You know, there's plenty of time to get into the vivek after the end, but at least initially give them the benefit of the doubt. That's the first point. Okay. Second point: sincere dialogue. People from different sides. We should have trained neutrals, facilitators who can bring devotees together, and help them hear the other side thoroughly. Or there may be more than, sometimes there's three or four different sides. To help devotees drop their assumptions about the other person, to improve communications. As an ombudsman, I can tell you, I have the number one complaint. I'll get the statistic in a little while. We're starting to analyze all the visitors to the ombudsman's office. But I can say that somewhere between 65 and 85%, the number one complaint that we get again and again and again and again is nobody communicate. No one told me before they did this. The leader didn't say this. It's communications. They didn't tell me. That was the main one. They didn't tell me before they took away my office, before they told me I had to do this, or before they kicked me out of the temple. There was no warning. Right? Communications was the number one complaint. And I'll give a little practical. There's so many ways a facilitator can help, but here's a real simple one that any of us can do. You can bring two devotees together, have them sit down, have one person explain their viewpoint, and then this person is naturally going to want to say a rebuttal or say something, right? Before this person can say what's on their mind, they have to paraphrase what the other person said to the other person's satisfaction. And only when the other person says, yes, that's what I said, then they can say their point of view. And then again, you reverse that process. You would be surprised how easy it is to do and how effective it can be. It slows things down to a much more sattvic level, and it forces people to have at least superficial empathy, and sometimes it goes much deeper than that. So I highly recommend that. And avoid the internet discussions. My opinion. But sincere dialogue and the ability to listen is so important. The famous, very, very important letter to Balavanta, December 13th, 1972. Now I want that we shall recruit more and more our men amongst the intelligent class. They, because they are a little educated, or they have some wealth or fame or ability, so they will sometimes be a little puffed up. But that's all right, they deserve it. Now we shall have to learn the art how to approach such higher class of men and attract them to apply themselves to this Krishna conscious process of self-realization. That requires much tact. And we shall have to expect to meet all challenges by sharp minds. But if we remain always absorbed in remembering Lord Chaitanya, how he converted so many intelligent men, even sitting for 3 days and nights to hear them speak without himself speaking anything. And if we remember how Krishna was so patient to explain everything to Arjuna, even Arjuna was speaking like a fool. In that way, being always tolerant of others and appreciating their points of view. Appreciating their points of view. 1972, college students, USA. What's their point of view? Drugs, sex, rock and roll. Maybe there's some remnants of 60s impersonalism. It's not a great point of view. Appreciating their point of view. It'll be easy matter for us to convince them gradually to join us. So understanding other people's points of view increases the ability to communicate. So that's my second suggestion. Third suggestion. Meditate and consider deeply Prabhupada's request for us to cooperate. My argument is that that's a truth, that the purposeful process of cooperating with other devotees in our society is a truth, and a very high truth, maybe not always the highest truth, especially if we start going outside the confines of Prabhupada's basic teachings. But my argument is that within the confines of the basic teachings, this is one of the highest truths, to cooperate with one another. Be willing to give other people space, to allow people to disagree for a higher purpose. And just to give you a few of Prabhupada's instructions in this regard. Now this displeasing of God brothers has already begun and gives me too much agitation in my mind. Our Gaudiya Math people fought with one another after the demise of Guru Maharaj, but my disciples have already been fighting even in my presence. I am greatly concerned about this. I'll try to make this a little shorter, but very important. Prabhupada is talking about unity and diversity. Therefore, I am suggesting that our men meet in Mayapur every year during the birth anniversary of Lord Chaitanya. With all GBC and senior men present, we should discuss how to make unity and diversity. If we fight on account of diversity, that is simply the material platform. Please try to maintain the philosophy of unity and diversity. That will make our movement successful. One section of men have already gone away. I think that's Siddhasarup Maharaj, etc. Therefore, we must be very careful to maintain unity and diversity. And remember the story in Aesop's Fables of the father of many children with a bundle of sticks. When the father asked the children to break the bundle of sticks wrapped in a bag, none of them could do it. But when they removed the sticks from the bag and tried one by one, the sticks were easily broken. So this is the strength in unity. If we are bunched up, we can never be broken. If we are divided, we can become broken very easily. And just one last one. You have dedicated... I am very concerned in the midst of such good reports that the devotees there are quarreling. This is not good news at all. And then he writes a letter within a letter to those devotees who are quarreling. You have dedicated your life to Krishna and therefore you should be ideal. We are introducing the Krishna consciousness movement for the harmony and goodwill of humanity. But if you yourselves are suffering from the very ills we are trying to remove, how can the people be influenced favorably? Stop this fighting. Tolerate. Hare Krishna. So what I'm putting forward is that it's a deep meditation, this point about Prabhupada's desire for us to cooperate, and that we even consider putting aside some what we think maybe should be right in ISKCON or shouldn't be right in, for the betterment of cooperation. It's funny, when I wrote this about cooperation on a certain email conference, I got back some interesting replies. One of them is very interesting. Fighting over power and position is foolish, this is the ISKCON devotee. But doctrinal matters must be clarified as they affect the very essence of our movement. Appa Siddhanta should be rooted out. So my take on that is yes. On the very basics of Krishna, of ISKCON, you know, if somebody's saying, you know, three regulated principles or eight rounds a day or something questioning Srila Prabhupada's position or, you know, things like that. But if there's differences in preaching styles or, you know, I would be careful with this comment about rooting it out. And I would think perhaps more we have to consider that vis-a-vis Prabhupada's instructions about cooperating. And while we're on that, so therefore I'm saying, you know, how in the beginning of the third chapter of Nectar Devotion, I believe it is, or maybe it's the fourth, the difference between principles and details. So yes, principles have to be established, and devotees, and especially GBC members, they're you know, the watchdogs of our society, they have to keep our siddhanta on the straight and narrow. But as for details, well, here's one suggestion that I don't think is going to be implemented in the next few days, but why do we sometimes fight over things on this level? Issues, major issues in ISKCON? Well, my suggestion is that perhaps it's because we think only one idea can be the idea for ISKCON. It's either Vedic culture or not Vedic culture. It's either women can do such and such or they can't do such and such. Or whatever, and so many varieties of issues. And therefore, people, you know, like I said, we dig our heels in, right? Because we want our idea to be what happens in ISKCON. Can there be a way that we allow differing views to coexist? And they already do. But can we acknowledge that they exist and have them coexist perhaps even in a more official way? We can perhaps look at what the Catholics did about this. I'm not a great scholar of other religious traditions, but I did talk to a person who's a scholar in the Catholic tradition, another one who's a scholar in the Jewish tradition. And they were basically faced with these kinds of issues. And they allowed different orders to be created in Catholicism, right? With the Franciscans and the Trappists and et cetera, et cetera. And they had their different takes on some of the details of Catholicism, but they had that principle, which I believe the main one was just accepting the authority of the Pope and the Vatican. And similarly in Judaism, there's the Orthodox Judaism conservative, just three more minutes, by the way, if you're wondering if he's going to talk on forever, reform, and now in the last few years, there's also the Reconstructionists, form of Judaism. And this has allowed them to remain a Jew, but practice it in a way that they're comfortable with, without telling all Jews have to be comfortable with the way I'm comfortable with. So can ISKCON adopt something like that in the future? It may be something we have to consider. It's an idea. And finally, suggest that we chant Hare Krishna. I know that's, I mean that quite seriously, and, you know, not just like the temple president or the, you know, the Bhakta leader, or just whatever the Bhakta's problem is, you know, chant Hare Krishna. But seriously, transcend our differences. Take shelter of the spiritual process. I know, easier said than done, but I was invited to give a talk about a month ago at a Mennonite church. And so I decided to go to the, it was after the sermon. They invite different lecturers and people stay and hear them. So they thought it would be interesting to hear from a Hare Krishna. So they invited me, and I decided to go to the whole service. And I'm really happy I did, because the Mennonite church is going through some very serious possible splits in their church right now. And the sermon was on unity. And it was very interesting. The pastor was saying, we don't want to just pat everyone on the back and say, yes, I'm okay, you're okay, and, you know, yato mat tato pat. He obviously didn't quote yato mat tato pat. But he said, we actually have to take shelter of the spiritual process. Mennonites are very into singing, and they're very beautiful the way they sing. And he was basically he said, we have to sing our way out of these conflicts. And I was like, boing, you know, sounds familiar, you know. We're the Sankirtan movement, right? Srila Bhakti, that's what we're here for, right? To chant Hare Krishna. And when the conservatives, the liberals, the all kinds of the thises, the thats, the one-legged Hare Krishnas, the heteros, the homos, the not knowing what they are, the this, the that, all come together and chant, you know, the holy name of the Lord, and overcome our differences. And this was a suggestion of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Very soon, the unparalleled path of Harinam Sankirtan will be propagated all over the world. Oh, for that day when the fortunate English, French, Russian, German, and American people will take up banners, mridangas, and kartals, and raise kirtan through their streets and towns. When will that day come? Hare Krishna. Questions? Comments? Anyone besides Prem City Prabhu? No, I just... yes, Prem City Prabhu. Question is, why do people, if a person has a different opinion than me, why do I want them to have the same opinion, right? Well, maybe some of you can help. You know, off the top of my head, my first reaction to that is this point that I'm saying that I see a lot, is that people, because they think only one opinion can reign, either in this temple, in this zone, or perhaps in this movement, therefore, they want theirs to be the one. And like I said, because we've given, as even Srila Prabhupada said in that letter, we've given up so much to become devotees. So we also, as a devotee, we have our certain take on Krishna consciousness. Our certain, of course, you know, right? And for that to be challenged can be quite disrupting to the heart. And this is why we're trying to set up a system to develop, to deal with conflicts. So that when a person starts feeling that need, that feeling defensive and therefore often wanting to strike out, there's a system in place in our society by which that feeling can be dealt with in a positive way, and those negative emotions can be channeled positively, and people can sit down and deal with things in a way that increases understanding. Now, obviously, that's not going to happen. Don't think that ISKCON Resolve is going to solve every single, you know, conflict in ISKCON. But having that system in place can help a lot. Maharaj?
Thank you very much for the talk. But still, I have some kind of feeling of something was lacking there.
That's due to your naive realism.
Yeah, no. No.
My realization was it was perfect. No, no.
Your suggestions are all good, but you started on talking about bigger issues. And you came down to this level of the conflict resolutions, which will always be there, and that's for that the mechanism you're suggesting is perfect, but at the same time there are these big issues. And I kind of feel that something essential is not there in your suggestions, in the sense that for the big issues we have to have another system in place. Strategically minded people, the board of strategically minded people who are, you know, dealing with this crucial issues of Siddhanta or whatever. Because, like, if we take a look on the history of Christianity, we will see that in the, especially now, because we are in a formative stage of the whole tradition, basically. And you explained and described the situation in a very dramatic way. It's very clear that there is huge diversity, you know, there's so much spread and so different varieties of conditioning are there. So what happened with Christianity in the first years when the Christianity became established or more or less established, there was a systematic attempt to get rid of all Jewishness in Christianity.
No.
Yes. So there was a very, very systematic attack on all the Jewish roots. And as a result, the Christianity became, I would say, somewhat artificial. It's a very artificial creation, because it was, you know, the traditional roots where it's coming from were systematically kind of driven out. So the same scenario may happen with us, because we are this, you know, we are coming from a certain tradition, but because we are so quickly spread all over the world, and all the different traditions, you know, at one point, and I hear this again and again and again, you know, we're not Indians, we're not this and that, we're not Indians, but still there are some culture which we have to preserve. So this is one of the issues with which you started, and so in your suggestion I didn't hear that we should really have some kind of board which would decide on the crucial issues.
Okay.
Strategically.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. My comment on that is, well, of course, your comment is one of the reasons why I tried to establish at the beginning of the talk that was within the basic limits of Srila Prabhupada's basic teachings. Now, what is included in that basic teaching, that is an issue, right? Because, like you're saying, for example, I might have been indicating that culture is outside of that basic, right? And maybe you're suggesting no, it should be inside, and that might be something that has to be discussed, right? That's a very important point, just as an example. But I would suggest that, especially that point about dialogue. You know, in the Bhagavad Gita, what is it? I forget which chapter it is where it talks. What is it? Vitanda, Vitandi, and Vada, and there's a third one. 10th chapter, right? Right. What's the other one? Tattva? No, Vada is the good one. Krishna says, I am Vada. Yeah, Jalpa, right. Vada, Krishna says, I am Vada, right? So, Vada basically means, I mean, from what I understand, and it's been a while since I read that, the commentary on that, but dispassionately sitting down and looking for the Siddhanta, the Shastric, right? So I would think that even in the kind of issues that you're kind of bringing up, the ones that really, you know, make sure that we're still linked to the parampara, basically, right? That's still certain atmosphere can be created by which the decisions, the way we decide our Siddhanta and keeping it on the straight and narrow, will be facilitated. Basically, trying to alleviate the political edge of it and get down more to the Shastric, and have make sure that those decisions are taken more in a brahminical mood than as a political reaction, for example. And maybe some of the things that I presented today might help even in that situation. But I agree with you that we're not, you know, we don't. That's why I was trying to present that. On certain things, ISKCON's going to, and especially you as a GBC member, other GBC members are going to have to say, this is our siddhanta on this. But how we derive that should be done as sattvically as possible so that the decision is vada. Is that okay? I think Shonika wants to say something about that. Okay.
It's just in response to Maharaj a little bit and what you said.
Yep, okay.
Because now we're going to get the vada.
The vada, yeah. You introduced so naive realism. I was just thinking, it just kind of struck me that this is the Kanishtha platform found in every religion, found everywhere. But we have in Krishna consciousness other concepts, other developments of consciousness. So if we're dealing with bigger issues, and we haven't dealt with this on an individual platform, we can't form a board of people that will be able to see things clearly because they won't be working in the proper consciousness. So the fratricidal war will still go on because consciousness hasn't changed. So to introduce an infrastructure that hasn't been purified, that isn't based on purity, won't change anything. It just changes the infrastructure. So you make a board of people who will solve all the problems. But what's their quality? Are they actually? It presupposes that we have transcended naive realism. But I think your talk, which was very good, better than anyone expected. but I think I do think we have it looks at the Kanishtha platform. You know, makes it a little bit more practical for us. And I think when we talk about different levels of consciousness, it also helps us understand how, because you didn't introduce the idea of transcending it as a concept. I think we have somewhat of a mechanism. There's a life beyond naive realism or Kanishtha. Could be the case.
Thank you. Maharaj?
Yeah. I also want to thank you very much for your talk. Your title, Pakoras or Pizzas, didn't... it didn't... announce this type of depth. I wanted to ask a question about the about conflict resolution. In the end, you made five proposals, and you said these proposals could work when both sides accept a certain frame, and you said what this frame is for regulative principles, acceptance of Prabhupada, and so on. I personally believe this is too little in order to make a conflict resolution, and I want to hear your response. I think sometimes people meet at one and have a conflict, and it cannot be solved if one person is a strongly confrontative individual. He lives by confrontation, and the other is trying to integrate views. Another, and I want to ask you about this condition now, or this situation, when conflict resolution might not work is when we feel that the other person is not truthful. In other words, he says something and it is not the fact, and we, it's not that only we view it because we are in this, caught up in this naive realism, but it's just very clear that he is lying maybe to himself. I have such a conflict with someone who is very dear to me, and I just don't know if trying to what I can do. I'm so helpless because I know that your advice of first understanding the viewpoint of the other and then paraphrasing it to his full satisfaction, that will take the mode of passion out of the whole thing and so on. Could you... When does conflict resolution work, or more specific, what to do in such a situation where the other party is lying or is untruthful, maybe out of weakness, because they can't, they have to hide behind something. What to do? Please advise.
Well, first of all, I want to say that the first thing that you said, I think, ties in very much with what Bhaktivedanta Maharaj said, and I think it's one mistake I've made in my presentation, where I've kind of combined interpersonal conflicts and societal issues into kind of a khichdi, whereas they actually should be somewhat separated and discussed differently, and there's some different approaches to that. And also, I think the other mistake I made is maybe not spending more time defining these confines, but rather I think it's one of the things that ISKCON leadership has to do, is really... where actually is our walls that we're just not, there's just no question about. How far does it go beyond the four regular, especially, for example, in things like culture, that's a big question and an issue right now in ISKCON as ladies and things like that. These are important issues. But now to answer your question. There are people that cannot be very much benefited by conflict resolution. If a person is, there's issues that are just unmediatable. It may be they're dishonest. There may be causes for that dishonesty besides conscious lying. They may be traumatized because of something. They may, there's a number of, and it's, so it's, as I tried to point out one time in the talk, it's not a cure-all. And it's not a cure-all. It won't cure everything. And it doesn't work 100% of the time. Our mediations in ISKCON are running around 75% success, meaning that some agreement is signed at the end of the mediation. But those are ones that we've chosen to go to mediation. Some of them we said, oh, this person may have a mental illness. And people have mental illness, they're just not ready for a mediation. Or it may be too close to some experience that they had that they just can't sit down with that person. Right? So it's not, although... I believe, and the GBC has agreed that having a systematic system is very helpful for our society. It's not that every instance is going to work with just, everyone paying obeisances and embracing each other and Hari Bol, which does happen a nice enough amount of the time to keep us enlivened, but it doesn't happen all the time. So, in that kind of situation, as our system gets more and more developed, I would suggest someone like you sit down with someone who's well-trained, discuss the situation, the person knows how to analyze conflicts, and can give some advice that, no, this looks like we should give this a try. Or, no, maybe this person should, maybe such and such has to happen before we give it a try. Or, no, just, Maharaj, forget about it. So, there is some training which, I'm starting to get to help in that way. We would hope that we would have enough experts in our society so that we can serve all the devotees, especially the leaders. One of my great ambitions in this project is to free the leaders to preach and be great sadhus and not have to deal with conflict so much, and to serve them and hopefully get some mercy from them. Does that answer your question? Yes, ma'am.
You spoke about principles and details.
Yes.
Again, like this.
Okay. Yes.
So isn't this itself the root of most of the conflict?
Deciphering what is a principle and what is a detail?
What is the detail, yeah.
Sometimes. And then sometimes it's a conflict about the detail or about the principle. In other words, it could be both. Deciding whether it's a principle or a detail. In other words, what is deciding whether it's contravenable or incontrovenable? Like, for example, Vedic culture. Is that an incontravenable, the thing, and therefore it's a principle, or is it a detail that can be adjusted? And then you could even say, it'd say, okay, it's a principle. The details of how to implement it, well, then we can also have quite just, you know, different opinions on that. Immediately, all women must cover their heads, and or, you know, whatever, you know. Or no, we do it gradually, or we emphasize education, and just naturally people start falling into their varnas, you know. Implementing varnashram would fall into that category probably as well. So both. Does that answer your question? It can be both. But I think it's a very, very important concept for us to think about principles and details. Because if we change a principle, we're in big trouble. And if we don't change a detail when appropriate, our preaching suffers. And we may become quite not very relevant to the world. So, and when Prabhupada was asked, how do you know the difference between the two? You know what he said? Yeah, he asked my Guru Maharaj. My Guru Maharaj asked him, how do you know what's a principle and what's a detail? And Prabhupada said, that takes some intelligence. And then he probably looked at him like, you know. Is there, let's see, we'll take maybe, how many more people have questions? I know one. Everyone's pointing at her. I see her. One. Anyone else? Two. Three. So we'll take those three, and then we'll call it a seminar. Is that okay? Okay.
I was appreciating your answer early on to the idea of objective reality, that Krishna has objective reality. That even if you consider liberated souls, that they're seeing things through their relationship with Krishna. You know, like Mother Yasoda is seeing when she wakes up Krishna in the morning that, oh, I guess he didn't have a proper bath last night. You know, she's seeing through her own particular relationship with the Lord. And we see that the different acharyas differ in the way that they explain philosophy. So even to determine principles is not so easy. And even in our own line, I mean, recently on the Shastric Advisory Council, we had to examine what appeared to be it started out to be a detail. And I don't think have we published it yet? I don't think so. Yeah. It appeared to be a detail. And when we looked at it...
Advaita Acharya's beard.
Yeah. And we started out thinking, this is stupid. Why are we looking at something such a detail as Advaita Acharya's beard? And it ended up to be a conflict between what our Srila Prabhupada said and what Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati said. And we ended up having to examine, what do you do when Srila Prabhupada clearly and consistently said something which was clearly and consistently contradicted by his own Guru Maharaj?
Acha. Okay. You're a better man than me for figuring that one out.
That's very funny. So it's not so simple. And talking about email wars, I ended up somehow being stuck on the long list of receivers of somebody else's email war, and it took a while for them to remove me on the list. And one of the devotees very nicely said, you know, there's only one opinion in the universe, and it's Krishna's. And one sannyasi who was on the list said, and you think that Krishna's opinion is the way you understand things. It's just, things are not so simple. I mean, even to say, what is the siddhanta, what is the principle? I mean, Prabhupada will sometimes in a purport say, this acharya says this, this acharya says this, this acharya says this. I mean, Madhvacharya will explain things in ways that nobody else explains things at all. Is he wrong?
I don't think so.
So how is it that his explanation is totally different? I mean, he's the only one who says, for example, that some souls are eternally condemned to hell. So how is it that he has that particular vision? How can we explain it? I mean, what do
and
you...
And am I supposed to answer that? No, or is that a rhetorical question?
No, you're not supposed to answer that.
Thank you.
But my point is that it's so easy to just say, oh, this person is deviating. This person is opposite anta. This person is in maya. this person is going to hell. And it, things are not always that black and white.
Therefore, I suggested that at least the first thing we should find out is why do they think that before we condemn them to hell.
And what I would like to suggest also is people, one reason that people think this way is we talk about that, we're often talking about that one of the qualities of a liberated soul is that they don't make
mistakes.
Mistakes. So this is a big thing. People say, well, you know, they don't make mistakes.
That's a big mistake.
Okay. So, and one time someone asked me that, and I brought up what you brought up in that letter about that. I said, well, even Krishna looks at Radharani and then he starts milking a bull instead of a cow. So what kind of mistakes are you not looking for?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Prabhupada said, well, we're going to New Virginia instead of West Virginia. So what sort of utopia are you looking for? You know, the gopis put their clothes on backwards, and it says in Nectar Devotion that the residents of Dwarka got so excited when Krishna came back that they all made a lot of mistakes. I mean, it says that right in the Nectar Devotion. So what sort of a utopia are you looking for? What do you mean by no mistakes? And Prabhupada defined that once as that no mistakes means you never do something that displeases Krishna. Your intention is always to please Krishna. So perhaps that's one cure for this idea of this sort of subjective realism that, wait a minute, that even those who are beyond the modes of nature, even those who are in the fully liberated state, that even they have different angles of vision on the absolute truth.
Thank you.
So what to speak of, you know, a little bit of broad-mindedness. I don't know if that's helpful or not.
Thank you very much. Two more, then I know you're all looking at that clock and saying, God, he's talking along. So last two that I promised Prem City Prabhu. No? Yes? This.
That's a very practical.
I like that, what he said in class. This Vaishnavi, that's what you said, right? Vaishnavi, yes.
It's just a really sort of practical question. I just wasn't sure if you were talking about a system of conflict resolution, and I wasn't sure what you meant. I didn't know whether you meant is that there's a system that ISKCON's put in place that all temples are adhering to, or whether you meant that it's something that we come to you for.
Thank you. I'll give a very quick, what do they call, plug for the program that I'm trying to help with. There's something called ISKCON Resolve. You can go to www.iskconresolve.com and learn more about it. But basically, we are trying, and there's many people in this room who are helping, Hanuman Prabhu, Meru, Mataji, and I'm sure I don't want to forget any others. My son, Gopinath Prabhu, and others, devotees around the world. Shonika, what are you doing? yeah, that's right. If it wasn't for Shonika, we wouldn't have any business. 2 years ago, the GBC body accepted the idea of setting up a conflict resolution system. Now we're broadening it to a conflict management system, and basically It's right now we have about 450 devotees around the world who've been trained as mediators. And very soon on that website, it's a website in construction, all their names will be listed and how to contact them. So if we have a conflict, we could ask them to help. Or you can just contact us at mediation, I think it's mediation@isconresolve.com. It's on the website. And we can help set up a mediation if there's some interpersonal conflict. We also have three devotees right now who are working as ombudsmen, which are people that you can go to confidentially. They'll never reveal your identity without your permission, and they will try to help whatever situation, difficulty you're experiencing that is related in some way or other to Prabhupada's move to ISKCON. We've had about 100 cases or so right now. Some of them really dealt some nice successes, some satisfied customers. Now we're talking about some other things to develop, something dialogue, which is before mediation. Okay, you're not sure that you're going to sit down with this other person and try to work out, but at least you'll sit down and talk to them. So we're trying to train devotees in that. We're developing a system, basically, globally, 103 countries, to help. We're also finding, it was very gratifying. I spoke to a sannyasi the other day who had visited a certain country where we had just kind of recently done two mediation courses. And what he said he noticed was that the devotees, having the theory of mediation and the theory of conflict management in their mind, were able to, instead of get down and dirty in conflicts, they were able to take a step back and look at it according to, you know, what we taught in the course, that conflicts generally go through this process, and to kind of figure which stage that they're at and how to deal with it. So it helped them, you know, have a more detached approach from it. So there's been some successes. We have a long way to go, and we're hoping for the blessings of the Vaishnavas to be able to offer this service to all of you and to Srila Prabhupada. Thank you. Hare Krishna.